And welcome everyone to a very special edition of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, Frank?
Hello.
We got a really fun show today. We are lucky enough to be joined by Bradford May. And Bradford is a producer, director, cinematographer, a huge list of big screen and television credits. His career spans 6 decades. And he's responsible for shooting a film that is very near and dear to Frank and my heart, The Monster Squad, which is one of those great cult classics from the late 80s. It was executive produced by Peter Hyams, co-written by Shane Black, genre specialist who everybody knows about, you know, Lethal Weapon and Predator and all those awesome movies and Long Kiss Goodnight. Fred Decker of Night of the Creeps fame was the director of Monster Squad, and the film was released in 1987, and it was one of those great films that sort of played off of the PG-13 rating back in the day when it actually meant something and involved a group of kids fighting a large band of monsters in their backyard, and it was a huge, huge hit with kids throughout, you know, many generations. And Bradford's also had an amazing career as a director and a cinematographer on television. His credits include The Twilight Zone, Dallas, Simon and Simon, Hawaii 5-0, Smallville, Beauty and the Beast. And he also has directed and acted as his own cinematographer numerous times, notably on the 2 Darkman sequels. So thank you very much for coming onto the show, Bradford, and we are very excited to get a chance to talk to you.
Frank, Nick, thank you so much for including me. I really appreciate it. It's a very nice intro, and it means more to me than you can imagine.
Yeah, it's truly our pleasure. I was ecstatic when Nick told me that he spoke to you about coming on the show because, Monster Squad's one of those films that I watch so much. I swear I wore the VHS out when I was little. And it's one of those films that when I'm older and watch it, there's a ton of nostalgic value to it. But as an adult viewer who's serious about viewing film, like I have become in the past 10 years or so, the film looks so good. And it's so thematic and cinematic. And it's very impressive to watch as a mature viewer now. Along with all the nostalgia as was brought along with it from when I was little watching it. But I had such a kick out of watching it. And, you know, as an adult, there's so many more things that you laugh at and understand, and you get it. So I just wanted to say thanks for coming on the show. I can't wait to talk to you about your amazing career. And this is just wild.
Thank you. I mean, when we went in to do Monster Squad, there was a little bit of problem between what Peter wanted and what Fred wanted. And certainly Peter was going to give Fred this opportunity. He had come off Night of the Creeps, and I just adored Fred the moment I met him. But the look of the movie that you're speaking of, Frank, is something that I kind of had to push through with the guys because they wanted a little bit more Disney-esque feel to the movie. And for those that may not understand what that is, if you look at an Adam Sandler movie, most of them are very bright. There's very little texture. They're colorful. They're pretty to look at. You hear and see the joke, but there's very little mood to it. And I felt when I read the script and I met with Peter and I met with Fred that I came at them with the idea that we were going to make a kind of felt like a black and white movie of the great monster movies, but only we had to do it in color. And also Peter wanted to shoot in 2.35, which for people that don't understand that is widescreen version. It's called Panavision. It's the wider squeeze version. Sometimes when you're looking at a DVD at your home, you'll see a lot of black on the top and the bottom. So it was a little bit of a fight. But not a fight, a creative fun, which is when you get on a project and you have all the various people that are involved. Everybody has an idea about how they want it to look, and there's only really one person that knows how it's going to look once you start shooting the movie. But I had a very clear-cut feel about what I thought we should do. So I thank you so much for seeing that and feeling the fact that in the treehouse it looked as if it was being lit a certain way. And I thought we had the proper amount of light to kind of come in between Disney and what I felt the film needed. And I was successful at it. And I have to thank Peter and Fred for allowing me to do that, and certainly the studio as well.
Yeah, the film, it walks that great edge between being a kid's movie and being slightly more than a kid's movie. And like you said, the lack of a brightly colored, saturated color palette or something more friendly or less aggressive to the eye might have created a different atmosphere or tone. One of the things about the movie Frank probably was also meaning as well, it feels like a film, like it feels real, it feels substantial. And part of that is the lack of CGI, the lack of, dated, that sort of element to it. The practical effects were so much fun, and the attention to detail, like even in the beginning, the awesome credit sequence with Van Helsing. I mean, like, that's so much fun, and you got a chance to play off of the old monsters and the old cinematic creations of these great iconic characters, Dracula and Wolfman and
Helsing,
everything.
Yeah, Van Helsing. Yeah, it was that whole opening sequence. I think it just automatically draws you into the movie. And we wanted to make a statement, and we wanted to make a quick movie, but we wanted to, from the very first image, to be very exciting. And I remember being in a couple of different screenings where people just started cheering. So it was before the movie ever started. So, we knew we were on to something at that time, but I don't think any of us, from Frank Yablans in the studio to Peter to Fred to Shane, knew really what it was going to become. And I think it's a great tribute to all of those who, greenlit the movie, decided this is a movie we should make, and ultimately coming to Bradford, May. And I think kind of rounded it out. The team became real, and I brought my trusty crew in, and we were able to really create some magic. And, it takes an awful lot of people to make that magic. I certainly don't do it by myself. Fred doesn't do it by himself. When you make a movie, it's a joint effort, and I think I've kind of brought the Bradford, May brand to making everyone feel that they are very much a part of the movie, from the people that serve the food to the people sweep the floor. To me, because I came up through the ranks, I have a tremendous amount of respect for everybody that's on that set and everybody that's working with me, not for me.
Great.
How
did you go ahead, Frank?
I was just going to throw in that I also credit Monster Squad to get me to watch the classic horror films when I was really little, because after I saw that, I was obsessed with Dracula and Frankenstein and the Creature from the Black Lagoon and,
sure.
and the Wolfman and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember getting all like the little plastic toys and everything,
sure.
and then going to the library with my mom and getting all the... getting all the old movies. So I do love that Monster Squad was my introduction into the classic horror genre, which is so fantastic. And I want to say real quick,
sure.
that I had no idea until I got older and became obsessed with the movie Manhunter and a lot of Michael Mann stuff.
Yeah.
And I had no idea that Tom Noonan played Frankenstein until I got older. And then that made the movie so much more great to me when I got older. And now I absolutely love it because I know Tom Noonan's the creature. And I had no idea for a very long time.
I hired Tom to do an Equalizer two-parter. Was a TV series in the late 80s with Edward Woodward, and shot in New York. They recently, Denzel just did a remake of it with
right.
Antoine Fuqua. And Tommy, when we did Monster Squad, I certainly wasn't involved in the casting. I wasn't the director at that point. I was busy building sets with Albert Brenner, Academy Award winner, so that we could make the crane shots and do the lighting that we wanted to employ. But Tommy Ed already met, and he had done this terrific 2-hour Equalizer. It was a two-parter, and he was just fantastic in it. And when we did Monster Squad, we met up, and I knew it was Tommy, and he knew it was me. He would never be seen without the makeup on. As an actor, he never wanted to be seen by Andre or the rest of the children cast, or for that matter, Stan, everybody. He always wanted to be in makeup. He never was seen until the wrap party. And he never, ever said to me, Bradford, he was Frankenstein. He talked in that word. He ate that way. You didn't see him when he wasn't working. I thought it was quite unusual. And at the very end, the last shot that we made with him on the back lot at Warner Brothers, with the wind blowing, and we had gasoline ritters blowing and lightning, and generators were jumping off the wheels, because in those days we had to do a direct short in order to get the lightning effect that I wanted, and not some cheesy kind of shuttered effect that you might have seen in some earlier movies. So not until that last shot did he come up to me and he said, Bradford, what a magical show we've made. And he said it in the Tommy Noonan voice, and I'll always remember that. Tommy's certainly a consummate actor. I haven't seen him in quite some time, but what a great Frankenstein.
That's an incredible story. I've read similar stuff about him, like in the film Manhunter, how he wouldn't interact with the cast, or he and William Peterson never met until the climax of the film. So that's great. That's great intro, or I should say depth into Tom Noonan's craft.
Yes, it is. And Duncan Regier, of course, had his moments, and he and Fred did butt heads on occasion. Duncan is a very strong, strong actor, and I think felt that he was going to be able to take advantage of the young upcoming director, and Fred Decker, but Fred stood very, very firm. And, Duncan then would look at me, and I would basically say, this is what the boss wants. And, this is when you get into a movie as a cinematographer, in this case for me, the boss is the director. He wants you to put the camera in a hole and fill it with dirt. Then that's what he does, and that's what I have the guys do for him. If he says, who put the camera there? I say, guys, get the camera out of there. The boss doesn't want it there. So it was kind of fun the way that Duncan would look to me, because we've had the experience, and I'd also worked on a failed pilot with Duncan, just so called, a couple of years before that. And he would look to me, and I would say, we're okay, we're good. You have to trust him. It's his movie, and we're going to all do the best we can to supplement what he does, because the director has a vision. He's got an idea and a style. And for everyone that he brings on is supposed to help him achieve that vision.
Yeah, you did a really – and, how many times Dracula has been put on screen before? All the guys playing each monster had a great chance to put their own spin on it. But I can't help but feel that, Duncan just – he did an awesome, cool Dracula. Like, it was just a different Dracula. It was classic without being completely dedicated to replicating something that had come before. We're certainly going to cover some other, you've had a lot of different stuff we're going to want to cover into this. So I guess while we're on the subject of Monster Squad, we can certainly continue.
Sure.
For you, what was it like to, and I don't know what, was your excitement to shoot all of these iconic monster characters in the same frame? Like, it's kind of like the Avengers of bad monsters. You know what I mean? This
yes.
is like a team of all these great guys before
that
was
analogy.
Popular. Yeah. So what was it like to get a chance to play with these iconic creatures in one movie?
I had the real dilemma of, usually these movies are shot at night. And we did have some day work, certainly, which you very rarely in color movies ever see Dracula portrayed, or do you see them? I mean, I had done a movie years ago called Love at First Bite with George Hamilton, but that's another story. I'm suggesting that when we shot our Frankenstein exterior, how was I going to keep him looking monsterish but friendly, because he had been found by the little girl? there were so many things that I had to adjust in the backlight of the sun to try to at least give it some feeling. I think that was probably the most Disney-esque stuff that I did, which was his first arrival near the treehouse. But with
the girl introduces him.
Yes, exactly. And you start on the feed, and there he is, and the guys all run and hide in trash cans. The dog runs and covers his face.
Yeah, I love the scene.
All of that stuff. It's a great sequence. And of course, like many movies, shot in totally different places. That was out at Disney Ranch, and of course, the house was somewhere else. And that's the fun of the photo fusion that I call, of making movies. But I guess for Duncan, for me, Nick and Frank, was the most exciting, because he's a very handsome man. He portrayed it well. You never really saw him otherwise than a bat. That was all it was. And he was always very, very debonair, and of course very hard to deal with. I mean, Duncan is a very, very method actor, and things have to be just right for him. And when you have gasoline Ritters pointing at you and the wind is blowing and it's 4 o'clock in the morning on the back lot and it's very cold, and I'm throwing newspaper in front of them, and I have the special effects guys throwing bark and everything else, and then he's impaled. Of course, we had to impale him, not of course, but we had to hang him in a certain position, which was quite compromising and uncomfortable for him. And, I just tried to assure him it's not going to be much longer, my buddy. I can only tell you it is what it is. Hang in there, buddy, because it was quite something, because we have to suspend him. Then they have to put the liquid smoke on him, and it takes forever, to achieve that kind of shot where he was impaled in front of the church. But overall, that, when he finds the amulet, those were, I think, some of his scenes that he was fighting hard to continue to be who he felt he needed to be as that Dracula. But I agree with you. I think that he's just fantastic in it. And along with Tommy, just beautiful work. I think my toughest thing was the creature from the Black Lagoon, because he didn't speak. So it was very hard for us to get a beat on what we wanted to look like. I felt, as years go by, that we could have probably done better. Greg could have done better with the outfit on him. But, the movie was made for certain people, and there's a suspension of belief. And we did the very best we could, because as we get back to what you were talking about, there was no real CGI. We did the vortex, and we did the vortex in the opening. But really, when you look at it, that's about all the effects that we really did. I mean, when he turned to a bat and he went, I mean, that was a shadow that we created, and it was old-time Hollywood.
Yeah.
It was just old-time Hollywood, and we're dealing with 1986, I think, middle of it, and I remember that I had been hired by Sylvester Stallone to shoot Rambo 3. And I had met with Sly that night, and we were good to go, and I had to tell Fred and Peter and Frank that I was going to move on, and I was going to do this, because they actually had come to me before that. And I'm just very fortunate that they were very persuasive, and I had to tell Sly that I couldn't do the movie and that I had made a commitment. And of course, I didn't work with Sly after that, but that's okay. Monster Squad was something that I had to do, and I think it was preordained.
Yeah, there's so many things about the Monster Squad that just constantly run through my head, and I just don't even really know where to begin sometimes. There is one thing I want to ask, and I wanted to ask you sort of before, that way if it wasn't true, I didn't look like an idiot, but I'm fairly confident in asking because I've read about it so much online. Can we talk about the town square set that's used at the end?
Yeah.
Is that that's the same set from what I've read that was used in Back to the Future and Gremlins and To Kill a Mockingbird? Is any of that true?
It is true. They also shoot a shot up at Universal. If you go on the Universal tour, you'll see where the big clock in the courthouse was used. I think Zemeckis used both Warner Brothers and Universal in conjunction. What that area was originally called, and it was certainly built well before that, was Hazard Square. And it was for the Dukes of Hazard. So, and many commercials are made back there as well. Where the church is and everything is the back lot at Warner Brothers Studios in Burbank, California. And the Lagoon set was also there. It is no longer there. There's an office building, unfortunately, where that once stood. But most of the movie was shot at Warner Brothers up in Griffith Park and at Universal at the top of the hill, which we did then use the Back to the Future and the Kill the Mockingbird area that we used for the mansion and some of the other things that we did there. But all the other interiors were at Culver City Studios. So, you know, the great thing about movies is they're shot in so many different places. That's the real thing that I think a lot of people don't really realize about film is that they just think it's shot from the beginning to the end and all those scenes and you just shoot that way. But it's all shot out of continuity and shot in many different areas to look like the same places. And I think that's what makes it very exciting. But you are true. Whatever you read, I think they printed the right stuff.
Good. And one of the things that sort of plays into that, the how much of Monster Squad was done on studio sets versus on location work or like a real, like a practical location? Because everything feels so uniform in that film. And obviously there's gotta be stuff that was done in a studio lot that never has that bad studio look or feel that even like, you know, like if you look at some of the studio comedies that come out nowadays, they look like they're so obviously plainly shot on a lot with no care or attention to the lighting. And, you know, I'm just curious because everything feels so complete and together. So,
well, I thank you. I mean, that's obviously, you know, a big part of the magic that my crew and I were able to create with Fred's genius. And, but the Warner Brothers back lot, the Mummy Unraveling was, in Griffith Park. Obviously we needed long roads. We needed a long throw. Very, very tough nights, a lot of shooting. Whenever you have cars on an open road at night in a place that's not inner city, you know, you have to do all the lighting, otherwise you don't see anything. So, and how do you keep it looking the same way? The whole army and the whole ending of the movie was shot in Hazard Square at Warner Brothers. That was about 10 nights just for the final sequence. And that's from Wolfman being shot and coming back together, and My Name is Horace, and the right up to the vortex and the teddy bear and the ultimation of Mummy Came Into My House. So that was all basically Mummy Came Into My House.
My favorite things, like
it's
in
a
the
classic.
Movie.
I say it to my kids all the time, you know, and I have since they were born. You know, I always go in the closet and say, "There's no monsters in here." But it's that part of it is just so classic. Is the throwing of the teddy bear to Tommy and Frankenstein as he goes away, and also making Frankenstein this lovable character. I think was a real genius by Shane. A total spin on it because you had Dracula who was, you know, give me the ambulant, you bitch. And then of course,
which is one of the greatest.
I mean, how do you beat that line? How can you beat that line?
Black to put that in there in the movie too. It's like you get this getting a chance to call a 6-year-old girl. How old is she in the movie? Six or seven or?
Yeah, it's five, six. You know, my daughter watching that.
They're a bitch. You know,
give me the ambulance. And then, of course, he turns around and you know, he's punched and knocked onto what we were talking about, where the spike on the church. But you know, Tommy and the teddy bear going away, I think, you know, even now that I when I watch it constantly, it always brings kind of a little bit of a tear. You get emotional because of where he had been and the little girl and how he helped the squad and up in the treehouse and the whole thing and Bogus and taking the picture of the non-virgin. I mean, all that stuff is just, it's so classic.
There's so much subversive humor in the script. What did people say about that script? Like, was this, and I would love to know, do you know if this was something that Fred and Shane wrote together? Or was this somebody's original idea and then it was, you know, worked on by the two of them? Because there's so many elements to that film that feel so ahead of their time and sneaky and subversive and just playfully vulgar in the right way without overstepping the bounds fully.
I agree with you on that. I think it's, you know, you have to credit Shane, and I think you have to credit Fred for, you know, I think Fred was 27 when he directed the piece. So, he, you know, he still had a feeling of it. I think the TriStar at that time was a little leery of the movie. And again, this is, you know, you're dealing, even if people can remember back that far, it, you know, there weren't a lot of things that were cohesive, calling a little girl a bitch, you know, of the virgin, and are you a virgin, and she's not a virgin. All of that stuff was very avant-garde for that time. And it doesn't feel like it because you think, hey, the 80s, you know, we'd already been through the 70s and here we are in the late 80s and this movie came out and it's almost the 90s. But, you know, that's a while ago. And this movie was, they stepped it up. And I think, you know, I got to give them, I have to applaud them all for allowing it to go through. I was a little shocked at some of the stuff that went on, but it was done in the best of taste. And I think that's why it was able to get through. And that's why I think it's beloved.
Right. Yeah. You touched upon a great point, and I wanted to circle back a little bit to the practical effects and the creature costumes, which I love, and I even love now. And I can't help but think I'm shocked that this movie hasn't been remade in some fashion. And I think it's good it hasn't, because if this film were made today, it would be all CGI. There wouldn't be creature costumes or practical effects, which is part of what makes this film so fantastic. And you know, my biggest comparison when Nick and I talk about remakes and stuff and CGI versus practical effects is the Carpenter version of The Thing and then the prequel that came out like 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
And how much better Carpenter's version is and how much better The Thing looks like, because it's an actual practical little creature thing and then a big creature thing. And then in the prequel, it's this CGI mass and it's not daunting or frightening whatsoever. It just, it looks phony. And it doesn't look realistic. As to where, like in you know, Monster Squad, whether or not it's dated doesn't really matter, because I mean I love when there's people in creature suits.
Yeah,
that's part of what makes the movie so fantastic. Like I love the creature of the Black Lagoon. The werewolf's amazing.
Yeah,
you know, I love the transformation in the phone booth.
Oh, that's
fantastic.
A great scene.
Yeah,
Tommy Grimes did a great job with it. And the, you know, it's all in the editing, of course. But again, guys, this is not. It wasn't CGI, and it wasn't Jurassic World, and I applaud all of that. But as a filmmaker, as a producer, as a director, cinematographer, and everything that I've been able to do in my career, I would not really want the movie to be remade. Obviously, that would not be my choice, but there was something that makes that movie so real because it's not full of CGI, and it makes it so much more believable that, you know, we're the Monster Squad, and that's really what it is. And it's, you know, Wolfman has nards. So we have to know that. We have to find that out at some point, that the Wolfman has nards.
That part lived in infamy in my house and within my friends, much to my parents' annoyance, ultimate annoyance for years, as I'm sure it did for so many parents who took their kids to see that movie. I mean, Frank, I'm going to say something that's going to probably make, you know, not surprise you in some way, shape, or form. At one point, Michael Bay own the rights to the remake of the Monster Squad. I don't know whether or not that will ever occur. Bradford, did you know that?
Yeah, I heard that it might be redone, but I had no idea that it was Michael. It certainly would have
put
a different
on the
spin
back burner.
Yeah, it would certainly have a different spin.
I remember reading it's almost insane to think that somebody hasn't made some sort of $75 million, you know, slick and cynical version of this movie in this day and age. Like, it's impossible to think that it hasn't happened. I remember reading that Bay had gotten the rights, and then just like many, you know, he'd gotten the rights to do The Birds, just like a lot of other movies that he has the rights to or had the rights to at one point. It never happened. And this is one of those movies where the charm and the not so much the innocence, but literally the charm and the way that the way that all of the elements came together at the time informed the final product in a way that I don't think that you'd get these days, where, you know, everyone's inclination is to do it in a computer and to make it in 3D and to turn it into a, you know,
IMAX situation.
Exactly. And we've lost the ability to be quaint nowadays. Everything has to be super crazy and wild. And Frank and I are the same way. We're proponents of 31 flavors of cinema. There's, you know, there's room for everything as long as it's well done. At least that, you know, that's my mantra. But I certainly feel that the old school charm of movies from the 80s and maybe into the early 90s, that stuff got replaced far too fast by a visual sophistication that, you know, has gone beyond our wildest dreams in such a rapid way. And maybe we can talk, maybe this sort of tips into another thing I want to ask you. Obviously, Monster Squad and much of your work shot with film, real film, anamorphic widescreen, 2:35:1, what have you.
Yeah.
How do you think about the onslaught of digital versus, you know, and everybody going digital and shooting digital? What is your take on that? Because being that you've been in the industry for as long as you have, you've had a chance to see every, you know, innovation over the last, you know, long period of time. So just curious.
I miss the smell of the emulsion because I was a loader, a second assistant cameraman, at one time in my career. We used to shoot with different emulsions. There was a different speed. There was only really one way, one person that knew the way the movie was going to look, and that was going to be the director of photography. We went to the laboratory in the morning. We ran the film without sound, without the soundtrack, to see what the exposures were and what the printer lights were. So I know, as much as I am and appreciate and am blessed to be old school, I have tried to adapt, which we must, and we must reinvent, and we must be not opposed to technology and forthcoming technologies. When it comes to whether Monster Squad would be remade on digital, would it be the same? No, of course not. Nothing is ever the same. But I think now that I have been using digital cameras and working in post-production with them, certainly there are tremendous benefits in cost for movies, the ability to color correct, the ability to do green screen work. I mean, the Iron Man movies probably would not have been the same kind of movies without the green screen, and nor many of these movies, obviously. And it has gotten so great that it would be really foolish of me and one-sided to be able to say, you know, oh my God, I loved film, and this digital world is, you know, for newcomers, and it doesn't mean I don't like it. It is what it is. I do miss film. I do miss the presence of film. But again, we hang TVs on our walls now that are, you know, an inch thick, that are LED, that make things look as clear as possible. I used to pride myself. My brand was to shoot film and create a mystique with film. That's not to say that it can't be done digitally, but there was an enhancement that the cinematographer had, the ability to push to contrast levels that are not totally acceptable in the digital world, yet they're getting better. The cameras are getting better. But I was able to create things photographically that I'm not able to totally do with the digital world. And that's not because I don't understand it. It's because it is not the same medium. So what we have to do is we have to embrace that. It is something that is in the future and it is coming. But I think, Nick, Frank, obviously, Monster Squad wouldn't have looked the same way that it did if I would have done it digitally for some reason. And of course, that, you know, when you look at it, you're a creative person. That was a time in my life. It was a time I read the script. I met with Peter. I had known Peter. I met this young director, Fred. It was, you know, I came home. I was on a high. I drove home saying, I'm going to make this great little movie. I'm really excited about it. And I don't think that would be any different today. But the film would not look the same because film and digital is a completely different medium, and I think people are understanding that now, and the normal layman may not be able to see that. But if you really do look at some of the old movies and Godfathers and Chinatowns, they're not shot on digital. They're shot on film, and there's a different use of emulsion and a different look of lighting that you cannot achieve in today's digital world because the contrast levels are so different. You have a 3-to-1 contrast level, where in film, I was able to go 6-to-1, 9-to-1 if I wanted to burn the windows out, if I wanted to have a hot lantern. Those things, you know, you've got to really be much more careful in the digital world. But listen, I'm embracing it, and it certainly has its wonderful capabilities as well. But I wouldn't want to go back and shoot Monster Squad with it now.
I mean, everything you just said is dead on. I had a problem even converting to Blu-ray.
Yeah.
When it first came out and high definition televisions, now however many years later, my place is overflowing with Blu-rays, and I have a 4K TV that I think is the greatest thing ever.
It is. But it is the greatest thing ever. It's just amazing. I mean, technology is crazy. You know, I looked at a Lucy when I was growing up. I looked at with a little TV pumpkin, black and white. It's unbelievable where we've come and what we've seen. And you guys, even at your ages, what you've seen, certainly from me, the cameras themselves and the ability for a director, a cinematographer to make shots has changed. You know, when I first started in the business, it took 8 guys to pick the camera up and move it and take it to a different position or move the dolly. Today, you know, we basically, you know, are picking things up or gluing things to the dashboard. And, you know, we have the GoPros and they're not 4K yet. I guess they're coming. But it's amazing what it's become. And it's certainly allowed the filmmaker tremendous amount of ability to do different things and put the camera where we couldn't put it at one time. But I still think it takes away from what Monster Squad was something that we wanted to base on earlier pieces. And we wanted to do it in our own way and in color. And I just don't know if it would be achievable in the digital world today. It wouldn't look the same.
No, there's no way it would.
No.
To circle back a little bit to what you're saying, you talked about like how it would take 8 guys to move the camera and stuff when you first started.
Yeah.
How did you come to the conclusion that you knew you were going to be a part of this world and this is what you were going to do?
Well, being fourth generation, and it didn't necessarily mean that I had to do it. I was a pretty good baseball player through Little League and through high school, but I knew that I had to make a living, and I had the ability to get in. And for some reason, you know, I always felt that I would get in the business. Now, I did not know that I would rise to the situation that I've been able to achieve. There's a lot of people in the industry that make a good living working as a camera operator, a camera assistant. You know, if anyone understands, there's a couple of assistants that work each camera. There's a camera operator that operates the camera, and then the director of photography, who is basically in charge of the lighting design, along with his chief lighting technician and the grips and the rest of the people that make it happen. So I was able to come up through the ranks and learn a little bit about everything. But I did have a father who was a cinematographer, and I did have a grandfather who ran the grip department at Fox in 1925. So I was able to learn, and I was very blessed to, in my earlier years in the business, to work with some really wonderful heavyweight producer, actors, cinematographers, directors, studio heads that I was able to take a little bit of all of it, and then, you know, you create your own brand, and I've been very blessed to have worked with some of the hierarchy in this business and learn from the likes of people that everyone would know, and I won't bore them with names, but I've done some really big pictures as an assistant cameraman and a camera operator with big actors, big directors, and you learn the pecking order of what a set should be like and how you go about making a film, because making a film is a very, very collaborative situation, and anybody that could be a part of that would be so excited to see what the outcome is. To be able to leave something behind is it's a legacy, and it's just a wonderful thing to be given.
And in addition to the insane amount of stuff that you've acted as a cinematographer on, you've directed any number of television episodes, feature films, television movies, and then the list goes on and on. What's it like to act as your own cinematographer when you're directing and to take on that challenge? And I, you know, I'll reference somebody that, you know, Peter Hyams, who's executive producer of the Monster Squad and one of those awesome, you know, shoot my own stuff directors, with just, you know, a wild career of great action and science fiction movies and stuff. How did you come to the determination that you were going to shoot your own stuff when you decided to become a director, and what was the progression for you?
I felt that I wanted to work with other cinematographers, and I love other men's work, and women's work. I just felt that on some of the movies that I was doing, the amount of preparation that we had, it was just going to be easier for me to get a crew together and pick locations, pick colors, the palette of the movie by myself, because there was a very shortened preparation on television movies, rather than having someone that I had to deal with. It was really just kind of cutting out a middleman, but also cutting out someone who could be someone that would help you be more creative and also bring his own or her style to the movie. It just so happens that I was one of the very first directors that the network let shoot his own movies, because they always felt that it was a two-man job, and it is. I was able to get by with it because I have a very unique way of working. I wouldn't put it on anyone. Actually, Peter and I first met on a picture that he was going to try to shoot. He was not in the International Photographers Union. It was a Fox picture for Frankie Blondes, and it was called Star Chamber, starring Michael Douglas. My agent called me and said, Peter Hyams wants to meet you at his office at Fox. And I was a young cinematographer, had done one season of Simon & Simon. It was cut short at 13 episodes, and we didn't think we were going to come back. So I was in between, and obviously I get a call from Fox, Frankie Blondes, big producer, Peter Hyams, who I certainly was admired and did not know at that time. So I went in and met with Peter, and he said, listen, I'm going to shoot this show, but I can't legally do that unless I have someone that is here from Local 659 at that time. Would you mind doing that? And I said, well, okay, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I'm going to have you go out and shoot some action stuff. There's this whole scene in a warehouse with Michael Douglas, and he's on the run and they're chasing him, and there's some explosion and stuff, but I want you to do that. And I, you know, if I see that and I know that you're going to do a good job with that, then, you know, I'll give you some more to do, but I'm basically going to shoot the movie. And I said, sure, absolutely. I would love to collaborate with you. I'd love to be part of it. I ended up shooting that warehouse sequence. And Peter and I became wonderful friends, still today. We're very close. I love him dearly. And that's basically what led to Monster Squad, was that situation. So, you know, sometimes in this business, you want to say yes to some things that you may not want to do because of what it might bring to you. And if I wouldn't have done Star Chamber, I wouldn't have done Monster Squad. So, and we wouldn't be talking here today. So those are kind of how some of the things come down in the business. I didn't get the credit as a cinematographer. But I met Peter Hyams and I met Michael Douglas, who I'd worked with on Streets of San Francisco years before. It was just, there's things that happen in this business that are supposed to happen, I think. And I think that way in life as well. But certainly in this business, it's such a small business. Everybody kind of knows everybody. And I was very fortunate that Peter brought me in to do that, because I not only got to show him what I could do as a cinematographer, and he also saw my personality, and he saw the way I dealt with things and dealt with the crew. So obviously he came back to me years later with Monster Squad, and here we are.
That's fantastic. That's a great story.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And if you have a chance to bring Peter on, he's the most articulate, wonderful human being. He's just a fantastic mentor, and friend, director, writer. He's basically kind of semi-retired right now, but is always full of wonderful stories, and he's got a gift.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll look into that.
You should.
Surely.
Yeah, you should. He's a great man.
I wanted to bring up real quick, yep. we spoke about it prior to us recording, but mm-hmm. the film you directed, Gramps,
yep.
with Andy Griffith, for anybody who's not familiar with that, I don't know how many people have seen it. I remember seeing it when it was on television when I was staying at my grandparents' house. Andy Griffith plays a psychopath in it. And it seriously ruined Andy Griffith for me when I was a little kid, and I couldn't get over it until I got older and could, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
I could put two and two together that he was just acting the role, and Andy Griffith from the Andy Griffith Show didn't turn into, you know what I mean, the sociopath that's in the film,
Frank,
terrorizing John Ritter and his family.
You're not far off of probably why the film didn't do too well. I think the overall audience that don't go back to A Face in the Crowd with Andy and the Kazan movie, which is something that you should see if you haven't seen it.
It's excellent.
It's a tour,
yes,
de force. It's a tour,
yeah,
de force. It's absolutely crazy. But I had known Andy because he lived in the same neighborhood as I do when I was growing up, and certainly I watched the Andy Griffith Show religiously. I mean, I was during the, in the 50s, and I'm certainly watching him in black and white and Don Knotts. And then to actually meet him, he was just finishing up Matlock. I think it was the last year of Matlock when we went to North Carolina. And I actually was chosen for the job because Andy felt that I had an edge. I had been doing some very edgy movies for NBC and CBS at that time. And, you know, whenever you start a film out at a funeral, it's pretty indicative of what the film is going to be. But I think a lot of people felt the same way that you did. It was very, very different to see Andy Griffith as this psychopath who was going to take John Ritter's kid and ultimately run away with him and be this, you know, person who beat up a maid and
right.
was after the wife. And I think a lot of people felt that way, and they hadn't seen him that way, which is, you know, kind of a statement when you have welcomed someone into your home via the television screen. We feel we know them. We feel we have a part of them. We feel, my God, that's Andy Griffith. That's Andy of me. He's walking along the lake, Ronnie Howard, and it's just hats and horns, and it's made in the 50s, and it's just much to do about nothing. It's a Seinfeld, really. It's a sheriff in a town with a barber, and it has nothing to do with anything. But then for me to actually be there and sit with him and be talking about story and script and actually directing him, was really a moment in time for me, because it was a statement for me as a professional that I had kind of come full circle. Here I was, a young boy watching this guy and never thinking that I would be doing a movie in North Carolina in 1995 with him as this psychopathic grandfather. But I agree with you, Frank. I think that it turned a lot of people off. And I love John Ritter. I played Little League with John Ritter, and God love him. He and I had such a great time on that movie.
Oh, wow.
His dad Tex was very involved in Little League and whatnot. We were here in Toluca Lake, and I had known John for a long, long time, but we had never worked together. And I went to NBC and I said, let's go after John Ritter for this. Let's bring John in. They said, well, John, we think of John as comical, and we're really trying to go another way with Andy. And you think, are you okay with that? Do you think, John, maybe we'll go with this other person who I won't mention? And I said, no, I think John can do this. And John and I had several dinners together, and we talked about the character. And I needed him to be very passive. I didn't want him to be, you know, Three's Crowd. I wanted him to be a different come at it in a different way. And he was able to achieve that in a great way.
Just a real quick for everybody. It looks like Gramps got a Region 2 release, and it looks like it's Russian. or something. I just looked it up on Amazon.com.
Oh my god!
And I need to get this. I'll send you the link. Okay. You got to see the cover art too. It's like it's insane.
And it's in Russian.
It looks like it's some like Eastern European language, like a block country. Yeah, I will. I will send it to
that
you.
Is absolutely crazy. Listen, you know, both of them are gone now. I stay in touch with Andy's wife, Cindy, and I'll do a quick story. Andy had a script supervisor who had done Matlock for all the 7 years that it was on, and she was living in North Carolina, and I kind of came in and I said, okay, I'll take a few people from Matlock, but, you know, I have to choose the other people that are going to be with me on this because I shot the film as well. I was the DP as well. It was for NBC and we did it. And I had to let her go. I just couldn't stand her for some reason. She just drove me crazy. And she was kind of knew that she was there and she was Andy's person. And it happened after work. I didn't notify Andy. I should have, in all due respect. So the next day was quite a ball game because obviously he felt bad for her. She was crying and she went, and it wasn't that she wasn't doing her job, it just that she wasn't cooperative. And I didn't feel that she was moving on. She was kind of fighting the situation, and so I had made a change. And it was my prerogative to do that. And as I say, I probably should have told Andy. And Andy, I walked into his motorhome and he hadn't slept all night. And he's a very emotional man and certainly very loyal. He had a wash rag over his eyes and he was laying down. And he made a couple of comments to me, which I will not say on the radio or on a podcast. But I said, Andy, it was a choice that I felt I had to make for the betterment of the movie. And I hope you're able to understand this, and I hope we're able to move on because I love you and I respect you. It just was something that I had to do, and I felt I needed to do. And from that point on, he was professional. He understood it. He got it. So you're dealing with someone that's been around for an awful long time, and you know I cherish that I had the ability and the advantage to work with not only Andy, but John, and they're both gone now. God rest their soul. We had a great time making the movie. The whole sequence in the rapids, I was throwing water on him. I mean, here's this 74-year-old man, and I'm dumping him in water. I'm dropping him over waterfalls, and he was just a gamer. And it's a moment that I'll never forget. But most people just couldn't understand Andy as a bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it when I was 10. It came out in what, 1995?
Yeah, probably 1995, 96. Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was 10, 11.
Sure.
So I'm buying this Region 2 Blu-ray.
Gosh.
Or this
I
Region 2
it.
DVD.
That's
yeah.
Unbelievable.
I'm gonna send it to you.
I mean, I have my old 3/4 that I probably should put on a DVD, but you know, it's never the same. But my old 3/4 machine. I think that's when I was getting my 3/4 at the end of the shoot, but that shows you how long ago that was done. But no, it was a lot of fun. We shot at North Carolina and it was a 20-dayer and made it for NBC, but it didn't do real well. I remember Warren Littlefield, who was in charge of NBC at that time, called me and he said, well, I guess they didn't like Andy as a bad grandpa. So, well, okay. Anyway, we'll do better next time. So, we went and we did Amy Fisher after that, so it was kind of
that was probably a much bigger hit.
Yeah, huge. Certainly not as good a movie, I didn't think, because more of a documentary looking kind of movie. But Gramps was an interesting movie. It was very interesting. If you get a hold of that, Frank, let me know, will you?
Yeah, I will. Right. I certainly will.
Please, I'd love to take a look at that.
We always like to ask people, you know, when they come on the show, what some of their favorite films are. What are some of your favorite movies or some of your favorite, you know, cinematographers or directors or people that you've always looked up to?
Well, I'll start with cinematographers that I look up to. Certainly, I put my father at the head of that list, Harry. A gentleman by the name of Bill Fraker, Gordon Willis, Jordan Cronenworth, Conrad Hall, Tom Del Ruth. These are guys that I learned from. I became an operator at a very young age. And I became a cameraman. I was the youngest director of photography in the United States when I became a cameraman in 1979 on a series called Simon and Simon. I had done the pilot as a camera operator, and when the show went to series, Universal was very, very kind enough to make me the director of photography on a brand new CBS, primetime show. And I did that show for 2 years, and then we moved off, and I was able to do other things. But I think some of my favorite movies are The Darkmans. I just love what we were able to achieve, my crew, myself, me working as a director and director of photography with the Toronto crew. We did them back-to-back, 1993-94. They're still making nothing but money for Universal. They were going to be released at one time as features, but they felt that the special effects didn't live up to what they needed. We made the movies very inexpensively. We made them back-to-back in Toronto. And again, very much like Monster Squad, we did not do a lot of it. We didn't do a lot of CGI. It was all in-house, in-camera effects. I had a ball doing the movies. I also did a movie for USA called Marilyn Bobby, Her Final Affair, which I gravitated to because I love the Kennedys. I love that whole Cuba, everything that went on in the 60s with Giancana and all of that. And that's what this movie was about. I put my own spin on it. A movie called Legacy of Lies that I did for USA as well, a real favorite movie of mine. And some of the movies that I've been doing, the family movies that I've kind of gone away from the edgy dramas into more of the family television with this new channel that we've launched, the Pixel Movie Channel, which is carried on Dish right now. And we're looking for other providers, but we're making some really cute rom-coms, and it's certainly different for me. I'm working with a lot of talented young actors that I am very excited about, and we're having a good time in doing that, and I'm able to stay at home and be with my family and not have to go on location. And that means a lot to me.
This is something that you started with Dish?
Yes. Well, it's actually our own channel. It's called Pixel, and it's 24/7, 365 movies without commercial interruption, very much like what you might see on Hallmark or Lifetime. We're making them at about 16 shows a year, and they're one brand new show a month, and they're rom-coms or rom-com situations, as I call them. And we're doing them here in Hollywood, and we're getting pretty successful at it, and we're getting a nice following behind us. So it's an exciting venture right now.
That's awesome. I'm on the website right now.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing that we're doing. And again, they're little movies. We're making them, inexpensively. We're using young and upcoming actors, in their 20s. And it's nothing but fun, It's boy meets girl, boy loses girl. Then there's a wedding and confetti and everybody's happy. That's how they kind of come down. But, there's some story and there's some fun to them. And again, it's a departure for me because obviously I'm, Monster Squad, Darkmans, and some of the earlier stuff at NBC, the Nancy Kahn story, and as I say, some of the grueling stuff that I did, the biopics that I did, Madonna, and certainly the Amy Fisher stories. Those were all, hard hitting and very edgy. So I was, basically known as someone that was very, very edgy. And when Pixel called me and said, "Hey, we want you to come and do some of these movies," I was very surprised because most of my stuff is on the edgy side, and the photography's on the edgy side. So it was, as I say, it's quite a departure, and again, a little bit of reinventing, which is not bad for any talent. As much as you can change with the times and for who you are and what period of life you're going through. I mean, I know I can go out and shoot, a sexy love triangle thriller, but I also want to be known as someone who is versatile and can attack just about any genre, because I think that's what makes a whole true filmmaker.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned your father was a cinematographer, and I just looked him up on IMDb, and I hope I have the right guy. Did he shoot Detroit 9000?
He did. Detroit
9000. Oh, my God.
Yes. And Alex Rocco just passed away not too long
ago,
actually,
yes.
About a week ago. And it was he and Harry Rhodes in it. And this thing is it's also kind of a cult classic, Detroit 9000.
Yes.
Very unusual movie and shot in Detroit. I was an assistant cameraman on it. My dad was the director of photography. And I really enjoyed that movie. I'll never forget my Uncle Tommy, who is known as Chainsaw Tommy, one of the premier key grips in all of Hollywood, just recently passed away. And we were prepping that movie. It was my first day in Detroit. Now, Detroit was not like it is today or in the last few years, but we were loading the truck. It was 12 o'clock at night, and around the corner comes a high-speed chase, and guys are actually shooting at each other out of the car. And we jumped on the truck, and he covered me up as the guys drove by, and bullets were flying off everywhere. It was, and I thought, oh, my God, this is Detroit. This is going to be one hell of a shoot. And that's kind of what our movie was about. But, yeah, Detroit's a rough town, and I remember going back there with great trepidation because even in those days, in the 70s, it was quite wicked back there.
I remember when I think it was Django Unchained came out on Blu-ray.
Right.
A three-film pack came out. I don't know if it was a Target exclusive, but I bought it at Target. Might not have been, but it was Detroit 9000, Switchblade Sisters, and The Mighty Pecking Man.
Wow.
And I remember I bought it because it was, I don't know, I think it was on sale with Django Unchained, so it was Tarantino's Rolling Thunder prediction,
right.
Pictures Presents, so I grabbed it because I love Tarantino.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched Detroit 9000. Nick, I don't know if you've seen it, but I'll send you the link to
this
pack that you just have to buy it. It's $10 on Amazon.
Please send me the link. I just, behind the scenes, I took a look at that particular type.
Oh, it's so good.
It was certainly a moment in time. You know what's so exciting, and I thank you for including me today, is the ability to kind of to walk back through memory lane a little bit and actually speak intelligently with some people that have actually seen some of this work. You guys are quite unusual, and you're doing a great thing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
really appreciate you coming on. This has been incredible.
You're you guys are obviously cinema verite guys that really pay attention and have paid attention for not just your adult life but your children, you know, being as children. I really commend you for it because you're not only buffs, you're pretty damn intelligent about all this stuff and some of the are providing, you know, moving texts that you've given me, Nick. You're quite an intelligent guy about what's going on, and certainly did your homework on me, and it's so appreciative. It really is. It's quite an honor to be with both of you, really.
Yeah, it's so nice of you to say, and like I said at the top end, it was just mind-blowing. If I had ever was told when I was 7 or 8 that you're going to get a chance to talk to the guy who shot the Monster Squad, amongst many other things, I would have told whoever that person was they were insane. So it's been truly a blast to talk to you, and the stories that you've regaled us with are fantastic, and it's abundantly clear that you've had such an awesome career working in various, you know, departments and projects throughout, you know, television and film. It's amazing. So and to say nothing of the family history, which is extraordinary. So thank you very much for your time and coming on the show. And if there's a movie that you're interested in talking about, like one of your favorite movies, I don't know what your favorite movie was, you know, last year, what you see in the cinema, or how often you go.
Yep.
But we'd love to have you on the show. We could do a podcast anytime you want to talk about a movie.
Yeah, anytime you want. You're more than welcome to come back.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That it means so much to me. It really does. I will do that. Please keep me in mind and include me when you need someone to babble on for an hour or so. I've got the stories, that's for sure.
Very nice.
Thank you. Yeah, real quick before we sign off, yep. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to your wife because I am obsessed with the movie Leviathan.
Okay.
And that's one of my favorite, like, creature, monster, sci-fi movies of the 80s.
Right.
And I think it's incredible that you're married to her. I had no idea until we were getting closer to the show, and I looked
Google.
You up on IMDb,
yep.
and I flipped out. I thought it was incredible.
Well, she still looks as fabulous as ever. Also, Beverly Hills Cop and Warren Remembrance.
Beverly Hills Cop, yeah.
Winds
yeah,
of War.
Frank told me the scenes.
Yeah,
so.
Winds of War. We still see Eddie a great deal. She's a great mom. She's not acting anymore. She's doing her best work is raising her two children. But I will let her know, Frank, because she is a consummate professional and certainly was acting since she was 7 years old. So she didn't even speak English at that time. She had just come over. She was born in Arabia and raised in Paris. So, I mean, she was like on My Three Sons when she was like 8 years old or 9 years old. But she's a wonderful lady and a great mother and a terrific actress. We've had the ability to be at the Academy Awards, and she's presented, and she's still every bit as lovely as she has always been. But I will tell her that, and I'm sure she'll appreciate it, Frank.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Yeah, this has been absolutely incredible. Thank you again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bradford. We will be keeping in touch for sure.
You are so welcome. Anytime. Anytime, you bet. And Nick, thanks so much. I'm glad we hooked up, and I've had a ball with you guys. You're terrific. Thank you very much, and good luck to you on your endeavors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.